Good morning, Boker Tov. And Chodesh Tov to everybody here. It's lovely to see people here. It's very nice to see people, a few people who I haven't seen here before. Welcome. I think we're going to have a very interesting examination here today of what we started last week. Last week we looked at part one of an analysis, an overview of archaeology and its impact on halacha and certain hashkafic issues. Today we're going to complete that for the benefit of those people who weren't here last week and even the people who were here last week. Let's recap a little bit what we said last Wednesday and we'll take it into today's shiur. Last Wednesday we opened up the issue generally of what is archaeology, where does it come from, what is the history of archaeology in Eretz Yisrael, and we looked a little bit about the development of that through the different periods up to the modern day. We talked for a few minutes about the impact of archaeology on our perspective on the biblical narrative, even though that's not really our topic, and we talked a bit about whether it challenges the biblical narrative or backs up the biblical narrative, and I gave you a lot of sources and references there that you can follow up in other places. If you want to get a hold of part one, by the way, you're very welcome to email the OU or email me, I'm happy to send it, or WhatsApp me, I'm happy to send it through to you straight away. It's also, it will be up on my website pretty soon if it's not up already. But then we spend most of the last time here looking at some precedents in halacha as to do we take account of archaeological evidence or do we not. And I brought you basically four different areas of halacha as precedents, and today we'll apply them in practice. One area was a Gemara in Bava Basra where Rabbi Bar Chana came across the Meisei Midbar, came across those who had died in the Midbar in the 40 years of traveling, and he wanted to cut off a piece of that tzitzit to check whether we pass in like Beit Hillel or Beit Shammai is the number of strings on the tzitzit. And for various different mystical reasons, he was stopped. He couldn't do it. He got back to the Beit Midrash, and they told him, why were you so foolish? You should have just counted them, and then you'd have known, and you didn't think to do that, etc. And we saw that there was a discussion in the contemporary poskim, does this prove that you should use archaeology, that you can use archaeology? He wanted to, or that you can't, because he was stopped effectively from doing so, or can you not take this source in any sense as a halachic source because the Midrashim of Rabbi Bar Chana are very deep and mystical in many different ways, but we looked a little bit at that. Then the second thing we looked at was the tefillin of Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. And we said that, as we know, there are people who wear one, there are people who wear both, and when we dig up ancient tefillin, we find lots of examples of different ones, including Rashi's tefillin, Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin. And there are classic sources that say, oh, we found ancient tefillin in the grave of the Cheskel Hanavi in Iraq, and they were this way and they were that way. And other people said, no, we don't know why tefillin were buried in Kfarim. Maybe they were buried because they were no good, not because they were yes good. And therefore, we saw that there was a bit of a disagreement on whether we could use that. Then we looked at the famous case of the Ramban and the shekel, the chetzi shekel, the chitzas shekel that he found in Eretz Yisrael. And we'll come a little bit more back to that Ramban and the parallel Ramban next week. This is a trailer for next week. Because last week we looked at the fact that the Ramban said that when he lived in Spain, he used to assume the halacha was like the rift, that the shekel was so big, the chetzi shekel was a certain size and weight. But now he moved to Eretz Yisrael, he says, when he writes there, actually I discovered real chetzi shekels, and I took them to the Shomronim, to the Samaritans, because he couldn't read the Ksav, we talked about this last week, and they identified this as being the Mechitzat HaShekel of biblical times. It turns out it was from the time of Bar Kokhba, or the Jewish revolt even before. And he said he realizes the halacha is like Rashi. He changed his mind. The halacha is like Rashi because he weighed the coins. And we saw also that that was met with some level of doubt. The Shulchan Aruch doesn't pass him like that. He passes still like the Rif, even though the Ramban found these coins. And other people were very unhappy that he asked the Samaritans, why are you asking the Samaritans? What's the trailer for next week? Because the second Ramban, which is very like that, is the one in which he says in Parshas Vayishlach, I used to think, based on all the evidence when I lived in Spain, that Kever Rachel was in the north of Jerusalem, because that's where the sources appear to point. But now I arrived in Eretz Israel, there are thousands of people going to Bethlehem, to a kever near Bethlehem. So obviously I was wrong. Kever Rachel must be south of Jerusalem, even though he didn't think he was before he actually got to Israel. What are the issues there? And that's what I want to look at next week. Next week is the yahrzeit of Rachel Imenu, or is it? That's a good question. That's one question. The Rashi on the parasha doesn't seem to think it is, by the way, but that's another thing. And we have to look a little bit about that issue and how that impacts on what we're talking about. But that was the issue of the Rambam. And the last issue we talked about halakhically last week was the tzitz. And we saw the Gemara in Shabbos where Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yossi says, I saw the tzitz. I went to Rome. I went to the museum there that Vespasian set up, the Palace of Peace or whatever they called it there. And I saw the tzitz and it was written like this. And therefore, how can you disagree? I have proof from my own eyes. This is how you wrote the tzitz, the place of the Kohen Gadol for the forehead. And even then, the Rambam was not so impressed. He said, I'm not going to paskin that's how you have to write the tzitz just because they saw a tzitz. The most I'll do is I'll say, you can write the tzitz that way. But maybe that was one of many examples. We just haven't dug up the others. And that's where we left it last week, and we said that there are many questions on archaeology, including, number one, the vast majority is still under the ground, and therefore how can I base a conclusion on what I have not yet found? And many conclusions in archaeology, we'll get to this soon with Rav Kook, are based not on what we have found, but we haven't yet found this, and therefore we are assuming that evidence, that absence of evidence is equivalent to evidence of an absence, which is not necessarily the case. Just because you haven't found it yet doesn't mean you won't find it soon. And the way that archaeology is interpreted is also very agenda-driven, and everybody has an agenda. Now, if everybody accepted that they had an agenda, then that would perhaps be okay, but there are people who claim to have no agenda, but they still have an agenda, and therefore archaeology is a tricky business. That's all a recap of last week. I want to bring it into a few practical areas, looking around 9 or 10 areas of halacha where this has come up in recent times and see if we can find a way through. First of all, we're going to be traveling around Eretz Yisrael a little bit today. That's not a bad thing now. The weather's cooled down. You can go out and about. So you can take some of these sources and go and visit the places. Let's start in Beit She'an. Beit She'an is not a place you want to go in the middle of the summer because it is very hot. So let's have a start in number one. Says the Gemara in Chulin. He heard Rabbi Yeshua ben Zoros. Ben Chamav shall Rabbi Meir. So Rabbi Meir's relative gives Edus here, the son of his father-in-law, his brother-in-law. Litnei Rabbi, and he gives Edus about Rabbi Meir in front of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is the editor of the Mishnah, the final formulator of the Mishnah. What did Rabbi Meir do according to this evidence? She'achal ala shel yerek bebet shan. That he used to eat salad in Beit She'an. Not a dramatic revelation, you might think, but actually this is, because there was a whole shaila about Trumas and Maaseros. Do you or do you not take Trumas and Maaseros in Beit She'an? And they're talking about Rabbi Meir, the context is that he ate salad without taking Trumas and Maaseros. Says the Gemara, oh, the Hitti Rabbi at Beit She'an kulu al yado. Based on that testimony, he said, Rabbi Meir can't have been wrong. Rabbi Meir knew what he was doing. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was a student to a large degree of Rabbi Meir. Based on the edus of what Rabbi Meir did, Beit She'an does not have to take Trumas and Maaseros, and he made a gezeira there and then. Anyone who lives in Beit She'an is exempted from Trumas and Maaseros. Why? Because it falls just outside the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael. Beit She'an, you should just know historically, is a very interesting town, very strategic town. It's on the junction, if you like, of the Jordan Valley and the Jezreel Valley. Okay, the Jezreel Valley. There was a permanent garrison of Egyptian soldiers there throughout the biblical period, and all through time, it's been mainly a non-Jewish town. A Hellenistic town in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. It was conquered by David HaMelech and then by the Hashmonaim, but it always had a name as being a very non-Jewish place. And therefore, it was just outside the borders of Eretz Yisrael, and Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi said, therefore it's Potter. The Rambam, Paskin is that way, number two. Rabbeinu HaKadosh, Hitzir Beit She'an Me'otam, Mekomot, Shelo Hichziku, Bahem Ole Babel. It was not somewhere that the Ole Babel went to. If we're all familiar with the Shemitah labeling in Rami Levi, if you know when you look at your vegetables in Rami Levi or wherever you shop, during Shemitah year, you'll see little signs saying Oile Mitzrayim, Oile Bavel, etc. This doesn't mean that's where your letters came from. It means these are from the boundaries of the Oile Mitzrayim or the Oile Bavel, and Shemitah is only defined by those areas, if you like, where the Oile Bavel came, so they came Second Temple time. And therefore the Rambam says, since Beit She'an was not there, it is exempt from Trumas and Mashrus, the Ravid adds, only on a rabbinic level, only for Salad, not for Shivas Aminim. This is not a shear in Trumas and Mashrus. But one thing is for sure, if you live in Beit She'an, apparently, you have slightly different halachas. So now the question is, those people who live in Beit She'an, do they have to take Trumas and Mashrus on their vegetables, on their salad? Let's say you have a vegetable garden in your, if you need a lot of water, I imagine, to grow vegetables in Beit She'an, but let's say you grow them. Do you have to take Trumas and Mashrus or not? They asked the Chazon Ish, and he said, of course you have to take Trumas and Mashrus. Ah, but the archaeologists say that the modern day Beit She'an is mamash on the site of ancient Beit She'an, therefore they should be exempt. Said the Chazon Ish, number three, this is a short translation of an excerpt from his letter, I am not acquainted with the endeavor of excavations and the study of antiquities, and I oppose this enterprise because of the many uncertainties involved. I'm not interested, I'm not convinced by the archaeologists. Now it must be said, the Chazon Ish died in 1953. The main archaeological excavations of Beit She'an started in 1980. And therefore we know an awful lot more now than we did in the 1940s and 50s. What the Chazon Ish would have to say about modern archaeology, we can only conjecture. But he's not likely to embrace it with open arms for reasons that we'll see. Other people also have that view. So if you live in Beit She'an, or if you're taking a vacation in Beit She'an, you better take Trumas and Mashrus, because you can't rely on the archaeologists. That's the first small introductory area. What about Rav Kook? Rav Kook was asked in 1912 about a community that felt they now lived on the site of an ancient community that had a walled city in the time of Yoshua ben Nun. So they say, now that we've re-established a Jewish community on the site of an ancient biblical walled city, what day should we read the Megillah? On the 15th. Why are we reading on the 14th? This is now a town. Chazal didn't mention that town. No, because Chazal didn't know archaeology. We now know this is where we live. Look at what Rav Kook responded. Again, this is 100 years ago, but it gives us a little window on this. Al davak tfiat kriyat ha-megillah la-moshavot be-platiyut. I'm now going to address this issue of which day these towns should be reading the Megillah. Eini moistiri chomer le-safek. I don't find enough material here to make an actual real safek. You should be reading on the 14th. And this is very important on a halakhic level. There is a rubud alma, there is a rive. Most cities were not walled in the time of Yoshua ben Nun. And therefore there is a presumption and a halakhic assumption that you'll be reading on the 14th. If you want to bring the archaeological evidence to shift that, it can't just be, well, maybe. Because, well, maybe is not enough to get rid of that halachic chazaka, that the roiv that you were probably not walled in the time of Yoshua ben Nun. And therefore Rav Kook says, I'm sorry, you brought me evidence, it's interesting, but it's not enough to be a real suffix to push off. And we'll get back in a minute when we look at Tchelet to that in more depth. Ki chol ha-chokhmah hazon, and he talks about archaeology, the whole chokhmah of archaeology, shel chakirat mada Eretz Yisrael, of digging up scientific investigation of Eretz Yisrael. Melech hi rak ha-shahot. There's a lot of assumptions going on, he says. She'anon ru'im heim l'chibur v'chavad ha'chokrim ha'dorshim b'zeh mitzad chibur ha'kodesh. He said, don't get me wrong. I'm all in favor of the science. I think we should respect it. We should like it. We should be excited by the idea people are digging up Eretz Yisrael and trying to discover aspects of ancient Jewish life. Aval sof kol sof. At the end of the day, says Rav Kook, you can't start fixing nails. One of the proofs they brought is, well, look, the Arabs have an ancient name that they've had for centuries, which sounds just like the name of the Jewish Yishuv that used to be there. He says, you can't rely on that 100%. If you have any other questions or doubts or observations, and let me know. Okay? And I will reveal my view, meaning I'm happy to hear more. I'm happy to hear more evidence, but based on what you told me so far, there's an Arab name here, and there's an archaeological idea here. He's not prepared to bring that into the halacha. Not because he disrespects the archaeology, but because he doesn't do enough to change the halakhic reality. I brought you in the footnote here. It's well known that one of the tools archaeologists use to identify ancient places is Arab, modern Arab names. And there are many Arab names that have been preserved. The Arabs don't even know why they call it that anymore. And we'll get to that next week when we talk about Kever Rachel. There are interesting sites north of Yerushalayim. I brought you some examples. Bet Jalla, which is, I drive underneath that every day, which of course is Gilo. The Silwan being the Shiloach. Tkua is Tkoa, Anata is Anatot, more about that when we get to Yirmiyah Novi. Latir is Beitar, Beitin maybe Beit El, Jabba is Geba. We'll see how that works soon. So even though those names are very interesting, maybe they're not quite enough. So too when it comes to coins, go over the page, please, on number two, and this will segue us into Tcheles. The Rav Kook here, also from around that period, 1913, is dealing with coinage. And he says, "Hinei ani choshev she'af al pi she'atchuna hamada'it b'chakirut keilu." Even though the nature of these archaeological investigations, "Benuya hi al pi roiv al yisod shel archeo hakitzoni v'lo ra'inu hi ma'arayot hayoter gedola." It's lo ra'inu. He's Rav Kook says what we said before. They based a lot on lo ra'inu. We never found it, and therefore we assume that. He says, you can't just take that on board immediately. Nevertheless, he eshel hashmit hasharot tumuchot, it should say b'mesoret. There's a spelling error there, sorry, it should say with a bet. Tumuchot b'mesoret. Well, you can't just set aside a mesorah, which is the way halacha works, based on an archaeological suggestion. Now, that's an interesting point. Because how does halakha work? Is it based on purely what's in the ground or what's out there in reality? And we'll talk about manuscripts at the end. Let's say I find a new manuscript that changes the way I look at a specific halakhic issue. Does that upend thousands of years of halakhic analysis? Or do we say, no. Halakha is based on Masorah. And Masorah is a little bit lamala min atavar. It's based on the way that Hashem has guided the Jewish people over the decades, centuries, and millennia. And you can't just upend a Masorah like that because you have some archaeological idea. And that idea came in very strongly when it came to Tcheles. Now, we had two whole shiurim on Tcheles about 2 or 3 years ago. I did say at the time that I was not a wearer of Tcheles. I must give you full disclosure that I now am a wearer of Tcheles, partly based on my own shiurim, whether that's right or wrong, but based on other people I spoke to at length, and although I could not get a straight answer on which particular shita of Tcheles to tie. I could not get a straight answer on that. Some people use that as a reason not to wear Tcheles. That's an interesting discussion, which is not for now. But when it comes to Tcheles, one of the issues that we talked about was this. The modern day revolution in Tcheles technology is based on the archaeological, fairly overwhelming evidence that the Murex trunculus is indeed the source of ancient Tcheles dye. And I'm not going through all the evidence now. You can look at my shiurim. I brought you reference to them online that they're up on the website. But the evidence is very, very overwhelming. Nevertheless, notwithstanding that evidence, there are many people who maintain, I'm sorry, it's not good enough. One of those reasons is Masorah. We have a Masorah that we don't wear Tcheles. Therefore, how can you bring now a new archaeological discovery to say that we should? And one of the main issues here, Rav Soloveitchik, opposed the Radzina Tcheles. Well, he's Rav Soloveitchik's great-grandfather, I should say, the Beis Alevi. In Russia, the Radzina Rebbe assumed in his day that the Tcheles was taken from the cuttlefish. Okay? And he had a whole Radzina Tcheles is a very well-known Tcheles. And the cuttlefish was, as far as he was concerned, the main candidate. And Rav Yosef Ben Soloveitchik, the Beis Alevi, wrote to him at the time saying, no, we do not accept the cuttlefish. We're not going to start wearing your Tcheles. And he wrote him a letter. Now, where it gets interesting is that there are two versions of the letter that the Beis Alevi wrote to the Radzina Rebbe. There's the version that the Soloveitchiks have, and then there's the version that the Radzinas have. Okay? And they're not exactly the same. Just pick up Rav Soloveitchik from YU in number 6. He says as follows. It is well known what happened between my grandfather Rav Yosef Dov Halevi and the Gaon of Rajin. The Rebbe tried to prove, based upon much evidence, that this dye was the true Tcheles. Rav Yosef Dov objected, saying that conjecture, hasharot, that we saw before, and proof cannot prove anything concerning matters which rely on tradition. Meaning, I don't care how much evidence you have. You can have overwhelming archaeological evidence. as Vidgornish helfen against Masorah, which rely on tradition handed down from generation to generation. In such a case, argumentation cannot be the deciding factor. Only tradition itself can determine it. And this very much fits with Rav Soloveitchik's halachic man. Halacha is a priori system. It's not something that is based on the realities around us. It's something which pre-exists and underpins those realities, and which is a Kabbalistic idea itself, almost based on the Zohar. Read Halachic Man, I'm sure, as you many of you have, and you'll see that this very much fits with what he says. That was the way of that our father saw it and acted thereon, and that is the way that the sons have to continue acting. And it's quite well known that Rav Soloveitchik spoke many times about Tchelet in his day, although the archaeology hadn't yet been as advanced, but still, I don't think he would have been impressed by what goes on today, and he did not wear tcheles, and that is the practice of many in the Soloveitchik family. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was opposed to tcheles, and many of his halachic mentors were as well, Rav Huttner, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, although I'll get to him in a minute. However, many of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's children do wear tcheles. Yes, Rabbi Ziegler. Yeah, he was a great-grandfather. He writes here grandfather, but he was his great-grandfather, because his grandfather was Reb Chaim. So he's Reb Chaim's father, correct. I think he means like Zaidi. I don't know what he said exactly in the original there, but that's the point he makes. However, it's not so poshut, because the Rajinas themselves say that's not what the Beis HaLevi wrote. It's not that the Beis HaLevi wrote that we have a Masorah that we don't wear tchelet. It's that we have a Masorah that we don't use cuttlefish. Okay? We don't use cuttlefish. But, according to the Rajinas, the Beis HaLevi wrote, but if we found something new that we were convinced by, then okay, we'll take a look at it. Which is very different from the version that Rav Soloveitchik seems to be saying that, I don't care what we find, we have a Masorah that we don't wear it. Whereas others say, no, and Rav Herschel Schechter is not convinced at all by the Masorah argument, and he does wear tcheles, and he feels actually, we saw in the Shiurim then, that if you don't wear tcheles today, you're in danger of breaching an Issa Doraita of Baal Tigra that you're taking away from the mitzvahs, because there is a very significant chance that we do have the correct tchelet. So again, this argument of archaeology versus Masorah, which version of that letter are you going to follow? Very interesting. Of course, then you have to get into a question, is why are there two versions of the letter? Is it that people misunderstood, or is it actually that the Beit HaLevi said different things to his family and different things to the Rajinas? Okay, that's an interesting question which I have no answers to. Rav Eliashiv is also very interesting, because really, Rav Eliashiv paskened also that you can't wear tcheles today because of its a lack of Masorah. And he says, just like the Rajinas said that the cuttlefish was tcheles and he was wrong, then Rav Herzog, in his PhD, decided it was the Jamfina, and he was wrong. So two of the Murex Trunculus people, they may also be turned out to be wrong. So you can't wear Masorah. We can't wear Tchelis based on this. However, even that's not so straightforward. Because Rav Eliashiv, Rav Herschel Shechtin himself says that that's not actually what Rav Eliashiv said. What Rav Eliashiv said is he asked the Ptil Tchelet people, Baruch Sturman, right? They came and presented to Rav Eliashiv, and they said to him, would you consider starting to wear tcheles? Because of course, if Rav Eliashiv started to wear tcheles, as the Rebbe Gate, getting out of the Hasidim, okay? So everyone, as he asked them, if all the Haredi world were to follow my psak and start wearing tcheles, what would the cost of that tcheles be? So they answered, well, the demand would be incredible, and the cost would be astronomical. We couldn't keep up with the supply. And therefore he said, okay, so then I'm not going to say you can wear it, because I don't want people to be burdened by the cost of having to buy tcheles. People have enough trouble making ends meet as it is without having to buy tcheles as well. Very interesting. They reported that conversation. He wanted it kept private. They reported, I don't know who they are, by the way. Someone reported that, in principle, Rav Eliashiv was not against tcheles, but he said it's too expensive, or it would be too expensive. Once that was published, he demanded someone write a clearer message that he was against tcheles, and then the tshuva came out about the Masorah, which he then said he actually didn't personally write, but he doesn't necessarily... You can see how these things are a little bit tricky. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is very interesting. He came out and said he wasn't in favor of the new tcheles. However, I had a conversation with Rav Menachem Borstein, who was one of the main innovators of tcheles, and he said he went to Rav Shlomo Zalman, and he told me that Rav Shlomo Sobel said no. He said, let's see and wait what the people do. I'm not in favor of innovating something new, but if the people develop their own Masorah, meaning Masorah is not frozen. Masorah can itself develop, and therefore if people start wearing it and people start establishing that as a new Masorah, maybe the situation will be different, and that seems to be what's happening. If you look around you, Tehillah seems to be catching on. Yes? Well, according to Rav Shechter, not wearing tchelis is worse, because the wrong tchelis, even the wrong tchelis, there's no real downside. Because when we say the tzitzis have to be lavan, lavan just means not tchelis. Lavan could be green, blue, black, red. So there's really no downside. Even if it's the wrong blue, then you don't lose anything. Unless you say you lose the idea that the tchelis have to be the same color, that tzitzis have to be the same color as the beged. Okay, and the Masorah argument. You can download the other shurim. I put all the arguments there and back. And the other thing is, you know, how strong does Masorah have to be? Many people in this room eat turkey. Why do you eat turkey? Because according to halacha, there needs to be a Masorah for a kosher bird. And somebody walked into the New World in the 16th century, looked at turkeys and said, well, they're nice big chickens, we'll eat those. Now you can say, so how do you know? And there are some people who don't eat turkey for those and other reasons. However, there are many people that do, and many people feel that actually turkey now has got a new Masorah. So again, we've established a Masorah that we do eat turkey, so maybe there's a positive Masorah. Yes?
Masorah should be based on knowledge, not a lack of knowledge. Without knowledge, we don't know, so we can't.
Well, Masorah may be based on the actions of Klal Yisrael as well. And we'll see that again when we talk about Eruv. If everybody starts doing something, and that takes the zeitgeist, goes in that direction, that itself can start a Masorah. Because we assume that in Einu Neviim Heim, B'nei Neviim Heim. Okay, we'll get to that at the end. Fine, so that's Adkan Tcheles. And again, as you pointed out, you asked, which is better, many people think that the Sofek, strong Sofek, that it could really be the real Tcheles, far overrides the downsides of actually not wearing it. Now, let's go on to a new topic. How do you place your mezuzah on the door? Up, across, or in the middle? So the Gemara says one thing for sure. Number 7, I'm a Rav Yehuda, I'm a Rav. Asa kemin nagar, if you put it like a bolt on the door, like a deadbolt, psula. That's possible. Whatever way you put it, don't put it like a bolt. So Rashi says, what's like a bolt? Number 8. Asa kemin nagar, shekal v'tachva b'saf, you put it into the lintel there, kenagar shetoch v'managirim b'kota kazeh. And he brings a little drawing, okay, which we'll get to in a second. The mitzvah of mezuzah, letetetaba orech b'saf kazeh. And he brings a little drawing of a horizontal one and a vertical one. This is a reproduction of the drawing that in the Vilna Shas based on the drawing of Rashi, okay? I don't think we have Rashi's original drawing. But he says that it has to be vertical. It cannot be horizontal. What the Gemara is saying is, you mustn't place your mezuzah horizontally. And that makes sense, because most bolts are horizontal. Okay? It's rare that you have a vertical bolt, although you do, at the top of the door, have a vertical bolt. So a bolt could go either way. Rashi says, no, what it prohibits is horizontal mezuzahs. Look at number 9, says Tosfos, the following. Perish b'kuntras. Rashi explains, mu'umad huksheira, that vertical is good. V'kashi l'rabbeinutam, like Rabbeinutam has a problem with this. Who puts foreign standing up? You don't have things standing up. Sefer Torah v'lucha sheba aron moshka. The Sefer Torah in the aron and the luchas in the aron were lying down, not standing up. V'loy ma'umad. K'demashma perikama de Baba Basra. He brings from Baba Basra. Afal pisha hayucholein la'anicha ma'umad. The aron ruma karuchbo. They could have stood the Sefer Torah that they put in the aron kodesh and the luchas, they could have stood them up. But they laid them down. Because who stands things up? Ela l'repetus Rabbeinu Tam, have you muyushiv. The mezuzah has to be, according to Rabbeinu Tam, it has to be horizontal. Well, the perish b'kuntres, and according to Rashi, Mohammed, it has to be vertical. But I'm Rabbeinu Tam, say l'madim, look, I'll bring you a proof. The hamasa b'chol yom, to the Sefer Torah, oimed ala bima, when the Sefer Torah is still standing up on the bima, okay, hakol oimdim, everyone's still standing. Now, exactly what kind of Sefer Torah he's talking about is a good question. Sounds to be it's a little bit more like a Sephardi type Sefer Torah. But it seems to be he's saying that when the Sefer Torah is standing up, it's still in transit. It hasn't yet reached its final place, and therefore everyone is still standing. But when they lay it down, oh, that's it. That's how you should leave a Sefer Torah. Then everyone sits down. So according to him, the mezuzah can't be standing up. It's like not covered. It has to be lying down. So what are you going to do? According to Rashi, it has to be vertical. According to Rabbeinu Tam, it has to be horizontal. Actually, not quite. According to Rashi, it mustn't be horizontal. And according to Rabbeinu Tam, it mustn't be vertical, which is a bit different. Because according to the second way I just said it, you do have an option, which is slanting. Meaning, if it has to be vertical or has to be horizontal, then how does slanting help? Because it's neither. Okay, if it's in a nishtaher and you're not doing anything. But if the problem is it mustn't be this or it mustn't be that, then oh, shkoyach. Now I put it like that. It's neither that nor that, and everyone's happy. Have a look at the Shulchan Aruch number 10. Tzrika Yod Tekufa. Says the Shulchan Aruch, he passes like Rashi, the mezuzah has to be vertical. Okay, Arkel Aruch Mezuzah Tapetach. With its length parallel to the length of the door frame. Says the Ramah, V'chei Nagu. And that's the minute. We go like Rashi, we put it vertically. Aval Yeshom Yoshep Sula B'Tekufa. But what am I going to do? Rabbeinu Tam says it's no good vertically. He cut it apostle. And it's Tzrika Yod Tekufa, it has to be horizontal. Arkel Aruch Mezuzah Tapetach with its 90 degrees rather to the door. Umedaktik him, and therefore you can put your mezuzah vertically, because that's how we pass him. But because the Ramo is Ashkenazi and Rabbeinu Tam has more of a strength, if you like, in his analysis, if you want to be careful, you can put it on a slant. And I think that's what you should do. And that's what we do in Poland. We have our mezuzahs on a slant. And actually, Take, if you look at the notches on ancient doors going back, you find some notches on doors from archaeology which are vertical mezuzahs, some which are slanting mezuzahs, but we have not yet found any which are horizontal mezuzahs. So is that a reason now, based on archaeology, to say, well, Rabbeinu Tam is wrong? Because historically, Jewish people have never put their mezuzahs on a horizontal basis. And the answer is, not quite. Because first of all, maybe we didn't yet find the homes with the horizontal mezuzah notches. Can you tell me that we're not going to find them? You can't. And maybe, Taka, we now have a Masorah, going back to the point, our Masorah is now to put it on a slant. It could be. It started as a compromise. But now it's Minhag. It's the Minhag Yisrael. And Minhag has extremely important tokef. And maybe it was always a machlokas, like Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam Tfilin. There was some that said this, there was some that said that. Maybe they put them on a slant because there were always people that said this way or that way, and that was their classic halakhic compromise. Yeah.
I heard a few weeks ago something very interesting, that in ancient times, all the mezuzot
were vertical. Right.
However, when there were the Crusaders,
okay,
and they... What they did was, they then...
Oh, they made them into a cross. That's interesting. So then they put them slanting so they couldn't make a cross. But you can make a St. Andrew's cross, I suppose, if you're very versatile. But very interesting. Very, very interesting. So the findings will put them vertical. What does Sfaradim do today? Vertical or slanting?
Vertical.
But it makes sense, because the Shulchan Aruch Paskin is vertical. He's not worried by Rabbeinu Tam. They say they know where they're going. Straight up. Yeah, I have a Sephardi uncle. He's very broad-minded. He said, listen, Sephardim Ashkenazim, Ashkenazim daven the way Ashkenazim daven, and Sephardim daven the way Hashem daven. He says very good. He's very open about it. Okay. So, let's move on to mikvah. We found hundreds and hundreds of ancient mikvahs. And we can see how they made them. Not just one or two, hundreds. And they're usually, constructed based on either Zaria or Hashaka. Now, this is not a detailed shir on mikveh construction, but if you're thinking of building a mikveh in your backyard, which some people do, our friend in Harnoff built a mikveh in the basement of his house, Zaria works like this. You take an existing kosher mikveh, which is just basically the basic size of a mikveh, and as long as you keep pouring non-kosher water into a kosher mikveh, it catches the water going in. So you can start with a kosher one and then increase the size by pouring other water in. Hashak is a little bit different. You have a kosher mikveh here and you have a large body of non-kosher water next to it because it's, let's say, pumps and pipes, etc. And you open up a tiny little hole between them and they just basically kiss each other like the wood nishikah. They touch each other like neshek, etc. Like something that touches. And then it makes the water kosher. Good. So we now know how to design mikvahs. Should we all now design our mikvahs in this way? I'll tell you something, it will be a lot cheaper. Because our modern day mikvahs are built with all the bells and whistles, and we connect them to the water table and all sorts of chumras that make them very expensive. Why are we more frum than they used to be in the time of the Beit HaMikdash? We know how they designed mikvahs, just build them like that. And the answer is, no, we're not going to do that. Why not? Because maybe that's what they did, because that's all they could do. Maybe if they could have done what we can do, they would have done it. You don't know. But technology now allows us to do far more. We have more money to invest in it. And maybe also, this is an interesting argument, maybe we should be more machmir today because of Yehudas Adairus. That's an interesting Hashkafa argument. Should we, as time goes on, be getting stricter or less strict? I'm not getting into that discussion now. We had a whole shir before Pesach on Chumrah and the morphology of Chumrah and how different Chumrahs work in different ways. But that's an argument. You're not going to find anybody making your mikvahs cheaper and less machmeh, except when it comes to men's mikvahs, by the way. Men's mikvahs are made on the cheap, because men's mikvah is a minhag. And therefore, if you have a couple of $100,000 to invest in a communal project, a men's mikvah does not come very high on the list. We put them in a woman's mikvah, because that's a real doraisa mikvah, until you end up with men going on to Har HaBayit, which was another shir that we had, because if a man's going on to Har HaBayit, you can't just use a very bidyeved mikvah. You have to use an all-singing, all-dancing mikvah, because it's now doraisa, and therefore you have to find a way to get the men into the women's mikvahs, and that, of course, opens up all sorts of interesting problems. But that's another shir, which is not for now. Let's go on to another topic, and then we need to move into manuscripts, which I want to have time for again. Purim. We already talked a little bit about Purim. There are various people that live in places where they now think they live in a place which had a wall. Beth El is a good example. The Yishuv of Beth El. So the original Beth El, if you look in Sefer Shoftim, it seems clear it had a wall. Do we say that modern day Beth El is on top of original Beth El, and therefore they should read on the 15th? People are not so convinced. Rav Shaul Yisraeli said no, they should read on the 14th. The archaeological evidence is insufficient. Rav Avadi Yosef said no, the 14th, but maybe they should read also on the 15th. It's always good to be machmir, have another day of Purim. Why not? You know? But Rav Mordechai Eliyahu said, actually, really? If I could get the rabbis to agree, we should really move to the 15th for Beth El, because he was convinced more by the archaeological evidence. Rav Zalman Melamed, who is the Rosh Hashiva of Beth El, as far as I'm aware, says no, we just read on the 14th, we don't read on the 15th, because the archaeological evidence is not that clear, and anyway, b'dieved, you're good on the 14th, even if you were meant to on the 15th, so he reads on the 14th. However, Lod is not like that. Okay, number 11, says the Gemara, I'm Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Lod v'Ono v'Gei HaCharoshim. Now Lod and Ono are very close to each other. If you look at from the signs for Ono, okay, I don't know where Gei HaCharoshim is, if it's a modern town or not. Mukvat Chama Mi'emad Yeshua ben Nun. They were all walled cities. So do the residents of Lod today read on the 14th or the 15th? So already in the 1940s, Rav Tukhachinsky in his calendar said they should read on both days. They should read on the 14th. And also Bisopik on the 15th, and most posekim say we should keep on doing this. Rav Weiss from the Eidah Haredi said that they should be extra careful to read on the 15th. It's not just a chumrah. It's like there's a real doubt when it comes to Lod. In fact, many posekim now say, I spoke to one of my friends, my son's friends really, who is in the Garin Torani in Lod, and he said, they asked their Rav Samad in the Garinda, and he said, really the 15th is the main day. They read on both days. But really the 15th is the main, so you see it shifted. As the archaeological evidence becomes clearer, it shifts a little bit, but they read on both days in Lod. Now for something completely different. One of the things that we struggle with in Eretz Yisrael is when we build large communal projects, it's not unusual to find graves. And when you find graves, what are you going to do? Because moving a Jewish body, and maybe even a non-Jewish body, is not a straightforward halachic issue. There are many, many problems involved. Look in the Shulchan Aruch number 12, please. Eim afanim ameis v'atamot. We do not move a grave, we do not move bones. Loi mekevah mechubad lekevah mechubad, not from a beautiful grave to another beautiful grave. Loi mekevah bozu lekevah bozu, or to a bad grave to a bad grave. Loi mebozu lemechubad v'at vein tarich loi mechubad lebozu. We don't move a mace at all. You cannot move a mace. Ubatoch shelah. Here's some exceptions. If you're moving into a family plot, afidu mechubad lebazoi muta, then that's okay. She'arev la'adam she'yeh noach etzel avotav. That a person wants to rest with his family in the family plot. There's a certain menuchas hanefesh that people want to have, that they're going to be in the family plot. That you can move a body for. V'chein kedei l'kovro be'eretz Yisrael. or to disinter, reinter Tiberi Neres Israel, you can do that as well. Mutter. And if you put the mace there in order to move it eventually, mutter, that's also mutter b'chol inyan. Or if it's not safe, in there could be grave robbers. Maybe people will rob the grave. That's also okay. Or sheichnasu bo maim, or water, or waterlogged the grave. That, there are a number of exceptions which make it halachically mutter, permitted to move a grave. And one of the interesting one of them is number 13. Says the Shulchan Aruch, Keva hamazik et harabim. If a grave now is in a place that causes damage to the public need, kegoyish who samach lederech, it's near a highway, it's near a road. Afiru nigva shamidad balasada. Even if it was buried there with permission, the owner of the field said it's okay, and the grave was put there. Mutar lifnoitzem makom tahor. You're allowed to move it, and the place is now, you can now use it. Meaning, if we need to build public highways along certain routes, and we find that there are graves, according to the Shulchan Aruch, the public need will override moving the grave. That's one of the heterim for moving a grave. Zainab, what are we saying? Absolutely, because you can't possibly leave the graves in Gush Katif, where they'll be destroyed by the people who live there now. And the question in Eretz Yisrael is usually not as clear as that. It's often a little bit greyer. For example, to build a new road in order to avoid a dangerous area and you have to move graves, okay, that's Kuach Nefesh, that will be fine. What about to build a hospital? Okay, that's a public need. What about to build new housing? Yes, I mean, we need housing. Could you move it a little bit to the right, a little bit to the left? That'll cost more money. How do you weigh that up? What about to build more shops? We need more shops? It depends on who you ask. Some people feel you always need more shops. Okay. What about if we find a grave and we can do interesting archaeological research on the bones? Now, there, no, that's not going to be a public need. So you'll see there's a gray area as to how to do that. And one of the key issues is the archaeologists will come along and say, it's not a problem. These are Canaanite remains. These are not Jewish remains. As far as I can recall, this happened with a new hospital down near Ashdod.
Right.
They're building a hospital. They find graves. All of a sudden, there's a mass public demonstration. We'll get to that right now. And the archaeologists are screaming, no, no, they're not Jewish graves. Go home. It's fine. They're Canaanite graves. There are no Canaanites demonstrating. They don't mind anymore. Okay? Do you trust the archaeologists? This is a big issue. And if you think about it, this is not just a theoretical issue. This is, do we get a new hospital or do we not get a new hospital? So if you go over the page, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but on page 5, I brought you two pieces here from Rav Yitzchak Breitowitz. Many of you know Rav Breitowitz, and we're privileged to hear his Shiurim and Divrei Torah around Yerushalayim. He wrote an article around 20 years ago on the desecration of graves. I brought you the link. You can download it. In the first piece, in number 14, which I'm not going to read, he talks about how this is not just a Haredi issue. This has become a little bit sidelined into, oh, people are making a fuss about nothing, or maybe not about nothing, but there are other factors, and it's a Chilul Hashem, and the living come before the dead, etc. And maybe just pick up in the second part. He points out that it's not just a Haredi issue, and there are many Dati Lumi poskim that have been very concerned about moving graves. He says, just in the second paragraph, you might find this interesting, in 14, in this regard, mention should be made of an important ruling by Rav Shaul Yisraeli, the recently deceased Rosh Hashiva at Merkaz Arav, that any activity or project which adds beauty to the land of Israel is treated as a public benefit. Its cessation or removal is conversely regarded as a nezek to the public. In order to avoid such cessation, bones can therefore be removed. It is irrelevant whether the public need preceded the gravesite or the gravesite preceded the materialization of public need. In either case, removal is halakhically authorized. In some circles, he says, Rav Yisraeli's sack has been taken to provide a carte blanche for the indiscriminate exhumation of bones for virtually any type of construction activity on the ground of the needs, quote-unquote, of the living take precedence over the needs of the dead, and that the settlement and habitation of Eretz Yisrael is itself a factor which adds tiferet, which is an interesting idea. This school of thought regards all of the Asra Kedisha, which is the people who protest as being a non-issue. While Rav Yisrael's definition of Nizka de Rabbim is certainly quite broad and expansive, I am not sure if even he would regard one less parking garage as a Nizka de Rabbim. Okay? Which is a good point, although parking is a bit of a nightmare, but still, you can manage. To move bones is a very serious aveira if you don't have to. In any case, the overwhelming majority of Rabbonim who address the matter, including Rabbi Yitzchak Krulitz, the chief rabbi of Jerusalem, have not been willing to go so far and would not permit the initiation of commercial development without the knowledge that bones are going to have to be, with the knowledge, sorry, that the bones are going to have to be removed. So there you see there's the grey area. Where are you going to draw that line? And it will depend a little bit on Hashkofa. The more you're into Tiferet Eretz Yisrael, the more you'll push it to, yes, we should move the bones. Yes. Yes, but that was a covered hametz, and that was intentionally done, and that's what the Shulchan Aruch says. If you buried with intention, this will be a temporary grave, then that's fine, because that was the process. And you're absolutely right; they would bury in a cave, allow the body to decompose, and then move the bones to the family ossuary, I think it's called. Yeah, and that was the practice, but it's a bit different today because we don't do that anymore, and therefore now it's not intended. But on the issue of the non-Jewish and Jewish graves, look at number 15, because this is where our Breitowitz hits this point. Archaeologists and occasionally some rabbis have advanced the argument that in many cases bones that are found at construction sites are of non-Jewish origins, e.g. from the time of the Crusades and the like, and may thus be removed and disposed of with impunity. They further argue that based on the principle of Roiv, that when in doubt, all cases of unknown bones should be assumed to be assumed to come from the majority class. Since there are many more non-Jews than Jews in the world, all found bones should be assumed to be of a non-Jewish origin, unless there is a direct evidence to the contrary. This position has been roundly rejected by the Gedolei HaPoskim, says Rabbi Breitowitz. Even assuming that the rules against Pinuk Hever do not apply to the bones of non-Jews, which is itself subject to controversy. Can you just remove any bones? In many cases, it is crystal clear, or at least highly probable, that the excavated bones are those of Jews, either by markings on the graves, such as the recently discovered Hasmonean tombs, or by their proximity to well-established Jewish grave sites, such as the number of bones unearthed near the tomb of the Rambam in Tveria. Thus, many of the archaeological claims are simply disingenuous. Even if the matter would be a genuine 50-50 doubt, the dictates of Kovod HaMet would necessitate stringency. However, as the great Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky noted almost 40 years ago, reliance on the principle of Roiv is misplaced and indeed cuts the other way. While a majority of the world population may be non-Jewish, the majority of bodies buried in Eretz Israel over thousands of years may certainly be assumed to be Jewish. Now, that's an interesting question. I mean, is that true or is that not true? I don't know. As such, the principle of Roiv, rather than allowing indiscriminate excavation, operates to prohibit it. And then the question is, can you trust the archaeologist? Can you trust somebody who doesn't value halacha? I mean, there are some archaeologists who are God-fearing and observant Jews. But many are not. Many are non-Jews. If a Swedish archaeologist comes and says, these bones are non-Jewish, do they have any nermonas? Or do they not have any nermonas? Oh, so good, we'll get to that in a minute. On the one hand, the Mishnah says in number 16, if you don't keep a certain mitzvah, you have no ne'emanut, you cannot be trusted in that particular mitzvah. But nevertheless, your point is a good one, and that's source number 17. Halokeach talit metzuyetzet, okay, mi Yisrael. If you buy a talit with tzitzit on it from a Jew, or mitagar ein Yehudi, or from a non-Jewish shop, and the non-Jew says, I bought it from a Jewish wholesaler. Yisrael Neman, kosher. The tzitzit is a kosher. The cave in the Tagarhu, this is Zaki Yopon, since there are a professional, they're a trader, Chazaka Shalakha Yisrael, we assume that they did do what they said they'd done, they bought it from a Jew. The Lai Maranafshe, because they don't want to ruin their trade. They don't want to discredit their name. Absolutely, if you just bought it from random Joe, then you can't trust what they say. So do we turn around and say that archaeologists would not say the wrong thing because otherwise they'd be discredited? Well, that's an interesting question. How much does the agenda, whatever the agenda is, drive, even if they may be discredited? All sorts of people have said all sorts of things which large numbers of other people discredit doesn't stop them from saying it. How you play that in is interesting. And I brought you, for all the doctors in the house, an interesting question. Do you trust a non-Jewish doctor on Yom Kippur if the doctor says this patient has to eat? If you trust a non-religious Jewish doctor on Yom Kippur if he examines the patient and says this patient has to eat? And the answer is, in principle, yes, but The Bir Halach is not happy. Look in number 18. Even if the doctors are non-Jew, you trust them, the person can eat. He quotes the Tiferes Yisrael. Because you have to think really carefully about who you trust these days. He says the Tiferes Yisrael, I've seen with my own eyes, the Shavkilem Nusayhu, they can't be trusted anymore. The Lachol Chole Kal, even for a small illness, Omrim, people say, Tamid always say yes, because he's Ani Yisaken, he mustn't fast, it's dangerous, better he should eat. They just say that, and they don't really care about Yom Kippur. The Gamla Indian wrote for Yisrael, even when it comes to Jewish doctors, many of them break Torah. They don't fast themselves because they just don't keep halacha. We have to think very carefully. Do we trust them or do we not trust them? And you have to go with each case by case. The Pesach has to decide. So it's not easy just to say, this person would never lie, because they have professional integrity. Because you have to have your eyes in the front of your head, as the Rambam says, not in the back, and know that these things are not so straightforward. The last point before we look at the last issue is, how do we write the letters? This is an important issue. Some people find, to their surprise, that they've got mezuzahs or tefillin which are written in the wrong ksav. So one of the key issues is the tzadi. The Ashkenazi tzadi, you see, is a slanted nun with a yud attached on the side. The Hasidish tzadi is the nun, but with the yud inverted. So which way is the correct way? So Rav Moshe Sternbuch, who is Ashkenazi, writes that actually we've dug out from the caves of Bar Kochba, we found ancient tefillin which used the Ashkenazi tzadi. And therefore he feels that is the correct tzadi, and that is the one that people should use, and certainly Ashkenazim should be careful, even when they're hearing Parshat Zachor, which is the Doraita, should be read from a Sefer Torah with the correct tzadi written in it. However, I don't think the Sfardim and the Hasidim are going to be running to use Ashkenazi ksav anytime soon, because they're going to say, well, look, we just haven't found the other ones yet, you know. And indeed, we found the Ran, who wrote in the 14th century, wrote a Sefer Torah using the non-Ashkenazi tzadi, which is not a surprise, because he was Sfardi, and therefore, no one is going to change their Masorah anytime soon, but you see how these are issues which come up as well. In the last 6 or 7 minutes, I just want to bring to your attention a fascinating parallel issue. I was thinking of doing this as a separate share, but I decided it's really the same question, so I put it together, which is, what do we do with new manuscripts? It's not exactly the same as archaeology, but over the last couple of hundred years, a lot of new manuscripts have been discovered and then published. And the classic poskim sometimes did not have access to those manuscripts. Are we going to change the direction of certain halakhic issues based on the new manuscripts that we found and say, well, if the classic decisors like the Shulchan Aruch had known about these things, they might have said differently. Or do we say, no, halacha is based on Masorah. The way that it works in practice, the hashkacha of how these manuscripts were found, actually impacts on the halakhic process itself. And I just want to point out to you a couple of things. First of all, the Rambam, in number 19, the Rambam was faced, just let's read a couple of lines of this, with a question in Hilchas Momonos. Yesh nuscha od mina Gemara. There are versions of the Gemara, he says. Shakotav v'hem sha'ayim l'chaveri. If you say to your friend, al tifrani ela be'edim, only pay me back. You lend someone $1,000, and you say to them, I only want you to pay me back in front of edim. Don't just give me the money or drop it in my letterbox or something. Give me the money in front of edim. The amar lo, and then the guy who owes the money says to him, b'raticha b'fnei ploini, u'ploini. I did give you back the money in front of these two edim. But now they live in Buenos Aires. So what can I do? They live in the other side of the world, Medina Fayyam. It doesn't have to be Buenos Aires, I just want to be clear. Okay? Einu Neman, says the Gemara, you can't trust the guy that says he paid in front of Edim, and then they left. Says the Rambam, V'taot Sofrim Hu. This is a mistake, it's a mistake in the text. Ulefikach Tau Amorim, and based on that mistake, the halakhic decisors have made a mistake on Imsek. Because they've used the wrong manuscripts. Don't forget, in the time of the Rambam, there was no printing. Everybody used manuscripts. And I've done research, he says. And I've done research in ancient manuscripts, and I found, no, the guy who gives back in front of the two witnesses and says they went to live at the... He's believed. The Higili Adiba Mitzrayim. This is fascinating. This is Rambam writes in Mishnah Torah. I managed to get hold of in Mitzrayim, in Egypt, Miktad Gemara Yeshana, some old Gemaras, Kotav Al Gvilim, written on parchment. I don't exactly know what they wrote the Gemaras on in the time of the Rambam. Maybe paper already, okay? Kamoshe Hayakosin Kodin Lezman Azeh Bekorav Chamish Meir Shana. Like they used to write the old Gemaras 500 years ago. It's really interesting. The Rambam's living in the 1200s, 1100s. So he says, I found manuscripts of Gemaras from 500 years ago. And I found different versions of this. And I found the halacha is taka that he is believed. And he uses these manuscripts in order to say we need to change the halacha. And that's why they've all passed in this way, which is really interesting. But then he adds, which is quite amusing, and of course, also it makes sense to say that the guy is believed. Why? What was the poor guy meant to do when he paid the money back? Amaloi, the fellow said to him, "Al tafrani ela be'edim, only pay me back with witnesses." Paro be'edim, and he paid back with witnesses. The chiyesh lola aso eta edim be'beisa soar ko yemein shaloi yelku. He's meant to lock up the witnesses now in prison that they should never go on holiday. Well, it makes sense, and that's important because he didn't just change the halacha based on the manuscripts. He changed it because it changed because it made sense as well. But he changed it, and that's very interesting that he did. If you look at two other examples, Rabbi Yonatan Eibeshitz, that's myth number 20 for now. Rabbi Yonatan Eibeshitz brings up the question of Kimli. What's Kimli? Sounds like it should be a drink or something that they sell to kids. Kimli is the following. If you are taken to Beis Din on a monetary claim, and the guy says you owe me the money, and the halacha, the majority position is that you taka owe the money, the person can turn around and defend himself and say, you know something? I don't owe you the money because I'm relying on the opinion of this minority opinion who would say that I'm exempt from paying the money. Kimli, I hold like that opinion. You have to prove that that opinion is wrong. Hamotzi mechavero, alavaraya. How do you know that that opinion is wrong? It's not the majority opinion, but it's good enough for me to rely on, and that's the principle of Kimli. Rabbi Yonatan Eibeshitz was asked, what happens if somebody find some new minority opinion in a manuscript somewhere and says, that's useful. I'm going to rely on that. I'm going to take this manuscript to Beis Din and say, well, you've never heard of this before, but I've got a manuscript of Chveis the Meiri who would say that I'm exempt. Kimli, I'm going to rely on this. Can you do that? Rabbi Yonatan Eibeshitz says, no. He doesn't think you can. And he gives a number of reasons here. In number 21, he basically says, because the established text have been worked over and over and over by analysis, and any mistakes in them have been rooted out. Whereas this new text, how do I know what that is? No one's looked at it, no one's worked with it, nobody has actually put the time in, and it's not just about the facts in the text, it's about the work that's been done on it. And he says that the people who established our halacha were people with Ruach HaKodesh, people who worked with Siyata DeShemaya. You can't just bring in a text. In Erevin, for any of you who went through the excitements of establishing the Northwest London Eruv, this will appeal to you. But in Eruv, in the Aruch HaShulchan makes the following interesting observation. There is a major debate in Halacha as to what is a public domain, what is a Rashut HaRabim. And the opinion of Rashi is that there has to be 600,000 people going through on a daily basis for it to be a Rashut HaRabim. The opinion of the Rambam is no. Any road in the public domain which is 16 amos wide, which is pretty much every road in every area, maybe not in the old city of Yerushalayim, etc. Any 16 amos wide road is a public domain. An Erev, an urban Erev, will only work, okay, if there's no Rishus HaRabim Doraisa. If you pass it like Rashi, you can build Erevim almost anywhere, because how many places have a road with 600,000 people? Manhattan, etc. is a whole discussion. But if you pass it like the Rambam, you can never build an Erev almost in any modern urban area. Because there's, what you need are walls, and you need gates which lock at night. You'll never get that past the zoning people, okay? And therefore, you can't build an Erev. The Aruch HaShulchan says, why do we hold like Rashi? All Erevim which were built rely on Rashi, because Rashi was the majority opinion of the Poskim, and the Shulchan Aruch says, even though it's a bit strange, this 600,000 thing, since the majority of the Poskim, the Rishonim, hold that way, that's how we go. Well, now, we found so many manuscripts, we know that's not how the majority of the Poskim go. Because we found this one and that one and the other one, and now actually the majority position is the Machne position. Are we going to tear down all the Erevim and say, you built all these Erevim based on a mistake? You assume this was the majority position, and it's not. And indeed, the Mishkanos Yaakov came in the 19th century and wanted to pass up all the Erevim. And it's not so straightforward. It's a big kula to rely on Erev. The Aruch HaShulchan says, you can't do that. There's a Masorah now that we have urban Erevim. Klal Yisrael rely on them. You can't just come in based on new manuscripts and start tearing everything down and saying that the halacha has to change, even if that means we're going to be lenient, extremely lenient. We rely on the fact that our Erevim are built with a Masorah of Klal Yisrael, and that's not how the halachic system goes. And the last thing I leave you to read for yourself, the Chazon Ish had a lot to say about manuscripts and was very unhappy with them. It did not bring them into the halachic process in a significant way. There are three articles in Tradition Magazine, which I've referenced in the footnote in there in the bottom of page 8. You can read those. I've brought you some extracts from them. Most of them basically say the Chazon Ish was very against manuscripts and bringing in new things. Rav Shneur Lyman says he wasn't as against as you think, but basically against. You can read those in your own time. But that's a similar issue to the archaeology. So Ad Kan, archaeology and halacha. What's our conclusion? Archaeology is important, but it's not definitive. And the more the evidence builds, the more you can start to bring it in. But Masorah and halachic second system is very, very important too. Next week, please God, we'll go further. 2 weeks from now, I'm talking about Ksav Ivri and Ksav Ashuri, which I think you'll find very interesting. And then for 3 weeks after that, I'm away. But we'll get to that later on. For now, Chodesh Tov, have a lovely Chodesh, have a good day, and we'll see you next week. Wheels in the sea? They found wheels, but are they the wheels of what kind of wheels? Yeah.